and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. And once again, I am Mocton, joined by, he's the chief defender of the faith. He's the man with the golden voice. He's the king of the casters. He's Mr. Brett Podcast. But Brett, again, I really don't care about you. We got a guest I want to talk to.
That's absolutely right. We have a wonderful guest. Super excited to have him on. He is a guitarist, he's a singer-songwriter, he's got a new album that just came out on February 5th. He is Aaron Lee Tasjan. Aaron, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys. Thank you so much for having me. A true pleasure to be here with you today.
Well, I'm super happy to have you on to talk about your new album, Tasjan. Honestly, I can't imagine anything knocking it off of number one for me for best album of the year, because it's amazing. I love it. So thanks for being on the show.
Wow. Well, thank you. That sure is a wonderful thing to hear. I appreciate you sharing that sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to it multiple times, and it's just, I think you catch something new each time. And I mean, just going back and listening to your other work in comparison, I mean, you can see all the pieces are there, but like it feels like you've put everything together in the right puzzle right now.
Yeah, you know, isn't it interesting how, you know, that a record is really like a recipe, you know, and like all the ingredients, you know, need to be just right, you know, the right pinch of this and, you know, the right cup of that. And it can take some time, you know, to figure that out, especially when you're a musician who's minded the way I am, which is, you know, I really approach my creativity with a super healthy amount of curiosity. And I just always have been that way since I was a little kid. Even before I started playing music, I was into all kinds of stuff. My favorite thing to do was to, this is some true like Midwest stuff here. So if this doesn't apply, like, you know, forgive me, but like rollerblading in the basement was a huge part of my youth. And I had my various tapes that I would rollerblade to, which, you know, was anything from like Boys to Men, Coolie High Harmony to like Kerplunk by Green Day. So I was like listening to a wide variety of stuff even as a kid. And so I think over time as a creative, like it became, you know, a little bit of a puzzle to like figure out how to fit all these different things that I love about music together in the right way. And, you know, it was interesting, like making this record. I spent a longer period of time working on it than I had on previous records on paper. But the reality of it was we were just kind of going in every day and cutting something, and then I would have to go on tour for like, you know, 5 weeks or something. And then I would come back and we would do a little more. So, you know, it was kind of an interesting approach in that it sort of allowed this time in between sessions for perspective on what was happening. And maybe that, you know, extra time sort of allowed me the opportunity to flesh out those details a little more fully and thoughtfully than I had before, only because I don't know if people are aware of this or not, but like the music industry is basically run on like a window of 2 weeks. You know, it's kind of like, you know, whatever you have to do, you have about 2 weeks to get it done, including making a record. So, you know, the preparation that goes in beforehand, you know, can definitely benefit people in that position. But I always found it to be a bit constraining. It's like I always just wanted a little more time to sort of consider what I was doing and felt like that was hard to get between all the touring and stuff like that. So doing a record like this was really beneficial for me in many ways. But I would say mostly in the way that it just allowed me the time and space to be as creative as I always have wanted to be.
So what is your process then for preparing a song or an album?
I mean, it's, you know, it starts with, you know, the song. I mean, that's where everything is based for me. You know, I came to music as a lover of songs. So it starts there. It's got to, you know, it has to be Something that feels like somewhere, it has to have at least some element to it of some place that I feel like I've never been before. And that kind of, you know, inspires me. And I end up, you know, writing lyrics sort of, you know, I'll sort of do an initial write of the words, like just as I'm feeling them, just as they're coming out, and then go back through later on and sort of refine things, you know, here or there, or sometimes even just rewrite the lyrics altogether. The lyrics are pretty important to me. And all this stuff can really be summed up by just taking the simple life lessons of a guy like Doc Watson, who used to go into the studio every day. And some days he would just say to the engineer, you know what, it ain't happening today, and I'm going fishing. and he had no problem with walking away when it wasn't right. You know, he didn't want to force it. And I think that's how I feel about songwriting, you know, in a lot of ways. It's like I want to create the magic moment, you know, that it just feels like it just falls out of the sky into your lap, and there you have it. And it's all, you can do that, but you kind of have to, it's almost like set, you know, you sort of have to set a trap for it in a way or something like that. Get your mind sort of working in that space, you know, and that also is a bit of a double-edged sword, because, you know, when you're just letting your mind flow freely like that, you know, all sorts of things can come in there. I can tell you from experience. So, you know, you got to be careful with that, because, you know, you don't want to start, you know, thinking negatively. At least for me, you know, that's a place that I, you know, have worked really hard in my life to kind of, you know, not give into. I think we all have those thoughts. But I really create music in a lot of ways, and write songs in a lot of ways to rally against them.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to, when you're touring so much, are you able to find creativity on the road? We talk to a lot of people who tell us that they have difficulty writing when they're touring.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? Like, I have never felt that way, but I'm just always writing a song. You know what I mean? Like, in my mind, whether I'm just driving around, or if I'm, you know, loading into a club, or if I'm in line at the bank, or whatever it is that I'm doing, in my mind, I'm usually humming a melody or, you know, a lyrical phrase or whatever. I mean, I walked down to the, we had some snowstorms here in Nashville the last couple of days, and I was able to walk over to the coffee shop after a couple of days of not being able to leave the house the other day. And I was just looking around the coffee shop and came home and wrote a whole verse about the pants people were wearing. you know, these pants were really speaking to me, and that, you know, and so that's the, you know, I don't know. I wasn't aware of any other lines that I had about pants. So, you know, it's like, there you go, off to the races again.
Yeah, I guess. And I think, is there like kind of, I think the willingness to write a song about pants, because I think there are a lot of people out there who would not be willing, who would be like, oh, I think we have to, you know, kind of follow the more box, inside the box element. But the willingness just to go anywhere and write about anything, I think it's a skill in itself.
Well, some people would say that those folks probably have more sense than I do. I love songs like that, man. I mean, you know, I just revere songwriters like Tom T. Hall and Loudon Wainwright, you know, you know, these kind of, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard the Bell Bottom song that Loudon Wainwright wrote or whatever. That's a great pants song right there. but it, you know, there is, I think, a level of, I hate to use this word because I just feel like it's so overused, but I'm struggling to find something that fits it better at the moment. But there isn't, for me, there is an authenticity to like writing a song about pants, because like I really like care deeply about pants. I know that's probably like a weird thing like reveal or whatever, but it's the truth, man. Like I think, you know, a lot about, you know, how, you know, a pair of pants falls on me and when I have them on and how it makes me feel and what it says about me to be able to confidently wear, you know, a pair of pants. It's like, I always have on something that somebody goes, man, I wish I could pull that off, you know, which is, you know, I suppose a compliment, but could also be kind of taken as like, that's definitely something I would never wear, you know? But, you know, I guess to me, it, you know, it's another chance to express myself. It's another chance to be a walking, living piece of art. And I just, you know, I want to inhabit my songs and live in them. And so getting dressed in a way like, you know, really helps me to fully realize that vision.
Well, yeah, it's so honest in and of itself. I mean, and like the lyrics are super honest and just, you know, reading some other interviews with you and talking about like the way that you go and look for clothes and stuff like that and the kind of style that you do want, it's, it all kind of bundles together and seems like a very honest, you know, version of you.
Yeah. And I think that's what it is. It's like, you know, if you're making a record, you're sort of asking to be seen, you know, and so, you know, if I'm going to be seen, like I want to be seen as like my most real, raw self, because I feel like it's those, you know, the same things that turn people off about me are going to be the things that the people who do dig it, like ultimately love about it. So I really understand that. That aesthetic and am happily misunderstood, but really love it when, you know, people, you know, can connect, you know, through all kinds of ways. And to me, that's, again, part of the point of doing it is it's like, it's not just about, you know, writing a song and putting it on a record that somebody can go to a store or come to a show or whatever and buy, you know, it's about, putting something on that record that's like a real representation of who I really am, that like hopefully, you know, human beings will be able to relate to, because I think on some level we all experience similar things. None of us is having the other's experience, obviously. We all have our own perspective, but there are so many things that we all go through, you know, in life that are relatable to each other. And I love the idea that in a time where, you know, everybody feels so disconnected, there are still these things that we can focus on and bring us home to the reality of where we all are, which is there are things that everybody has in common.
So then how old, did you have something?
Sorry. You know, it's interesting because, you know, I listened to you talk and it, you make a lot of sense. And the reason why you do is because you have that rare ability in your lyrics to completely bear yourself out there for people. And you know, there's no lyric that is a throwaway line just to get the rhyme. It's, you know, that's what's really impressive.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead, Brett.
Well, I was just like, what I was going to ask is, like, what are the oldest songs on the album, and like how long have you kind of held those around? Because I know that, you know, again, reading some of the interviews and you talk about Feminine Walk, so it's like how long ago was that written? I mean, it's a great song.
Thank you. That is one of the oldest songs on the record, interestingly enough. It came to be in 2018. I was on tour supporting the last record, and we were supposed to play a show in upstate New York, and a huge winter storm came in and they had to cancel the show. And so we were sort of holed up at this really sort of Bates Motel-ish kind of establishment, where, you know, my bass player Tommy and I were rooming together, and we were just like, you know, hearing, you know, just terrible arguments through the walls and all that kind of stuff. Look, so something out of a like Tom Waits song or something. But I don't know. I don't know why or what. I think I just, it just happened upon me. You know what I've been thinking about? I've been thinking about this time when I was a kid. I was on vacation with my dad. We were in Wisconsin, and I was maybe 10, 9, something like that. And I was standing on the corner with my dad, and this like older kid walked up and pointed to me and said to my dad, he's like, "Hey man, like, I'm sorry to bother you or whatever. I just got to know, like, is that a boy or a girl?" You know? And I was thinking about it, I was like, "What? Like, I wonder what." I mean, people say the most amazing things all the time. Like, I'm just constantly surprised by the things that people seem to be willing to just offer up freely. But, you're just sort of like, wow, like what, I wonder what it was that prompted him to ask that question. I'm just, you know, walking down the street or whatever. And so I think there was some sort of connection that I made there, maybe of just like, you know, somebody's walk tells a story, you know, and so what's my story about how I walk, you know, and what does that mean to me? You know, and that song just kind of, you know, fell out without really analyzing that super hard. And that felt ideal to me because again, it felt like just a capturing of a moment. This is how I felt about this as these thoughts were coming to me for the first time, and that's what I like about music. That's what I love about records. You know, I like the idea that Otis Redding wrote Dock of the Bay the night before they recorded it and came in and said, "Hey, what do you think of this song, guys?" You know, and so those are the kind of moments I'm hoping to create as a songwriter, and that felt, you know. Obviously, Feminine Walk is not as good as Dock of the Bay. I know that, but it felt like a really like crystallized moment for me of just like, yeah, of stepping into my own, you know, skin really in a way that I hadn't before, and I was really happy that I had found that place.
How many other songs then that you have written would you say are also from like those crystallized moments?
Let's see. Dada Boys was another one of those. Mm. I wrote that in a hotel as well in Gothenburg, Sweden. We were playing a tour of Scandinavia, and we were in Gothenburg for a couple of days, and I think it was the second day or whatever. I just got up and opened the curtains, and all I had was a 12-string electric guitar because we were touring overseas, so I could only bring one guitar, and for some reason I brought an electric 12-string. sat on my bed. I wrote the song on that guitar, and my friend, again, with Tommy, and maybe Tommy's a good luck charm. Maybe I just need to get Tommy in the room to write good songs. I don't know, but he kind of looked up from his book and was like, "No, it's pretty good, man." this is a good path to go down, you know, because normally when people get interrupted with their reading, they're really, you know, frustrated by it. But he stopped to say, like, yeah, that's I'll give it a thumbs up. So yeah, maybe a lot more credit is due to Tommy Cyphers than I'm initially acknowledging.
Yeah, it's one of those cases that I don't think anybody can truly read when your tour on tour and then traveling with somebody who wants to write a song at that moment.
Totally, man. Yeah. I mean, the road is a funky place, you know, it's like everybody's, you know, kind of, you know, constantly internalizing, you know, especially, you know, if you're in a band with a bunch of guys, you know, it's like, no one's going to be, you know, man, like, I really, you know, I saw a rainbow today and it reminded me of my dad. And, you know, like, we're more of a sort of, we make a lot of fart noises. We read, you know, passages of I have a Glyn Johns book in the van that I like to just pick up and read passages aloud from on occasion. And then we listen to music too, but the sharing of feelings, you know, doesn't always happen. So, you know, you're kind of, yeah, you're internalizing all these things, writing a song, you know, kind of publicly like that, you know, it's sort of, you know, I think that in and of itself is a very human thing. You're risking a lot of embarrassment doing that, you know, but that's what rock and roll is. I mean, if you're not willing to be embarrassed, like, you probably shouldn't be doing this.
it's so true. Like, I know this is something we've talked to a lot of people about, like, but do you get nervous? Do you get kind of stage fright before you go up on stage?
I do. And I always have. I used to chew gum all the time, to just for something to do, to take my mind off it. And then when I was 16, I was playing guitar in the Columbus Youth Jazz Orchestra, which was a sort of an all-star Central Ohio big band. And we were invited to perform at Lincoln Center in New York City for a high school music jazz big band competition called the Essentially Ellington Competition, which was bands from all over the United States coming and playing the music of Duke Ellington. And I was chewing gum on stage during the performance, and some people from the Jazz Arts Council of Columbus, Ohio had come to watch us perform, and they were just horrified that I was chewing gum. I think they felt like I was too accurate a representation of the state of Ohio or something like that. And it just scared them. You know, they didn't want it. They didn't want the world to think we were a bunch of gum chewers. So they kind of put me off of that. But nowadays I have a lot of like different like breathing kind of things that I do and stuff like that. Or, you know, sometimes I'll just like walk out of the dressing room door into the alleyway and just, you know, run out to the street, you know, as fast as I can and then come right back, you know. I think it's more of like, you know, almost more than shaking off the nerves. It's like, I want to get up there and feel like I'm already in the middle of it. Kind of like the show started in the middle of a sentence, if you will.
Yeah, I can totally get that.
What would be your ideal concert setting?
Oh, man. You know what? We did this tour with Cheap Trick one time, and they played this gig. I'm trying to remember where it was, but it was like a theater in the round kind of thing. You know what I mean when I say that? Like, mm-hmm, that's like, yeah, some old Shakespeare, like Globe Theater, Stratford upon Avon kind of vibes. But it's like this, you know, theater where the stage is completely surrounded by the audience, and that is incredibly fun. It just turned the whole room into the stage, really, you know. And I went out into the crowd and did some interviews with some people mid show and stuff like that, and I had a great time. Anything where, you know, where the audience is, you know, can be as much of a part of the show as I am, like, that's probably my favorite.
Yeah. So
sorry, go ahead, Brett.
Oh no, it's okay. You can go.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask,
you know, you want to, come on.
Of course I do. Of course I do. I was going to ask if you think of yourself as a singer guitarist or a guitarist who sings?
Ah, that's a good question. No one's ever asked me that before. You know what? I probably think of myself mostly as a songwriter, and I'll tell you why. When I was 11 years old, I was born in Wilmington, Delaware. And when I was 11 years old, my family moved from Wilmington, Delaware to San Juan Capistrano, California, which is in Orange County. That was where I started playing guitar. But my first guitar that I bought, you know, was like a Hohner three-quarter size acoustic, cheap acoustic guitar. And I didn't know a note, I didn't know a chord, I didn't know anything. And I went home that day from the guitar store with my new guitar, and I went up to my room and I borrowed my mom's Radio Shack cassette recorder that she used to, you know, dictate meetings for her business and stuff on. And I made up a song for a kid from my old school back in Delaware that was getting bullied a lot. And I made a song up for him, having no idea how to play the guitar at all. And I recorded it on the tape and I put it in the mail and I sent it to him. So really, you know, my very first desire with the instrument was to connect with people through song.
Wow. Yeah, that's
very
awesome.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's really cool. I'm just thinking to myself, Brett and I need a song written right now. We could probably just send it to you, the notes, and you'd have it back to us in 20 minutes, the way it sounds. Your music videos are every bit as interesting as the album itself. Thematically, they work together, and they're all very imaginative. I kind of picture myself that this is what's going on in your head as you're writing the songs. But how much do you take part in the creation of the music videos?
Yeah, my main music video collaborator, and he's the artist who did all of the new music videos for this current album, is a guy named Curtis Wayne Millard, who is every bit worthy of such a wonderful and strange name. He's from Mexico, Missouri, and he kind of looks like he should be in the movie Easy Rider. You know, there's a lot of headbands and ripped denim. And he's kind of like, you know, an altruistic version of Matthew McConaughey's character in Dazed and Confused or something. It's like the party master, man, you know, and he, you know, he really has, you know, he's known me for a long time. So there's a depth of understanding of where I'm coming from there. But, you know, what's great about my relationship with Curtis is I can, you know, write a couple, you know, a paragraph or two of, you know, this is the kind of stuff I'm imagining. I want to fly in a car through a pinball machine on a planet that, you know, is made up entirely of arcade games. You know, as I'm exploring, you know, the existential nature of social media and whether or not it's played a negative or a positive role in my life or whatever, and just zip that off to him in an email, you know, and he'll write me back and his response will be like, cool. You know, because not because he's like blowing me off or anything, like he just gets it that much, you know, and has this wonderful ability to just take my sort of insanity and actually like make it a reality. You know, Curtis, you know, built one of the cameras that we had to use to shoot the pinball thing. He had to build a camera that had all these mirrors around it, because he actually went over to a guy who restores pinball machines' houses and took the top off and film and put the camera through the pinball machine as though it were, you know, a car flying through. So he had to make a camera in order to be able to shoot that in the way that he wanted. He shot every single thing all by himself, edited every single thing all by himself. You know, he had one, there was one, the very first video, Up All Night, when we set the house on fire, he had a second camera guy there that day just to get another angle, but that was it. Everything else he did completely on his own. So it's a collaborative effort at the beginning, you know, in terms of me just sort of expressing some ideas and some concepts that I really want to put across in the video. And then it becomes, you know, a true, you know, sort of Curtis, you know, kind of interpretation, and then sometimes he'll even embellish on what I've done in a way that I find really interesting. So he's a great creative partner for me in that way. I'm really fortunate to have someone like him.
Yeah, it sounds like a fascinating process. Like, did you shoot the stuff like kind of all at one time for the three?
No. I mean, I suppose you could kind of say that. I mean, we shot the first two within a period of like 3 weeks, I would say, and then there was some time I think we just hit the holidays or something like that. You know, and so there was, you know, we weren't doing anything for a couple of weeks then, and then we, you know, finished everything up right before the end of the year there. You know, it was kind of satisfying in a way because of the way the timeline worked out, just with the pandemic or whatever. Like, we were finishing these videos and then they were literally coming out like the next day sometimes. So it was really like in music, you know, I don't know if people are, you know, hip to, like, you know, you finish your record and then it's like, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 months sometimes.
At least, yeah, for sure. A long time.
You know, in this way, it was like the creative, you know, payoff of that just felt amazing. So I, you know, I would definitely say, like, you know, for all the terrible things that the pandemic has brought, like, that sense of immediacy with the creativity, you know, has been a little refreshing in a way.
So then does that make you more of like a singles guy, or do you still like have a firm belief in the full album?
Yeah, I totally believe in the album, man. I think a great record is its own thing. I don't think there are artists that I love who I don't think make great albums, but release great singles, you know, and you know, I enjoy their music just as much. But I do think, you know, I really, you know, when I was, starting to become a musician, you know, at 12, you know, 13, 14, figuring out like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And this is, you know, I feel like a big part of who I am and all these kind of things. You know, I was listening to records with all these things in mind of, you know, what's the sequence and you know, and I love, you know, how this song makes me feel after having just heard the last song, you know, and paying attention to that kind of stuff in a way where when it came time to make my own records, that was the idea. You know, I want to make albums. I want to make, you know, things that are designed to be listened to from top to bottom, you know, in a specific order and you're hoping to give, you know, someone a specific feeling from hearing it that way.
Well, you definitely had me with Sunday Women. There's no question that, the second that I heard that, it was just like, well, everything's great. I'm good. You know,
oh, thank you.
Yeah. It's 'cause like, there's an art, I think, to making an album and then like, it's not because, and like you say, not everybody has it. So like, how much then do you think about the art of the sequencing and just everything, like even the cover of the album?
Yeah. I mean, it's all of those things to me are just as important as the music, you know, and in a lot of ways, the visual might even be more important in some ways because that's all anyone's ever, for some people, that's all they're ever going to know of you because mm-hmm. they're not going to listen to your music, you know, but, I can, you know, I can still bring those folks some joy, man, because, you know, I think that's what that sweater vest says to me. It says joy, you know, and I'm, you know, and that was a piece obviously that I made, you know, the intention was to just make somebody smile when they saw it, you know, purely and simply. So, you know, in a very direct way, you know, the visual aesthetic is like, you know, paramount. And then it informs, you know, the rest of the record a lot of times. Like, I love to go to the Dollar Tree. A lot of times when I'm recording, if I'm on my way to the studio and I see a Dollar Tree on the way, I'll stop, even if it means I'll be a little bit late, just because I find a lot of inspiration there. They got a lot of cool pairs of sunglasses in there. They got a lot of weird, you know, fashion and stuff like that going on in there. And it's like, you know, you can walk in there and you see something and you get that picture in your mind. And then you know, I think about that when I'm singing, or sometimes I'll even buy whatever it is and wear it to the studio, you know, because a part of becoming this song. You know, I don't want to have to, I don't want to have to go up there and think about how to translate a pretend feeling. You know, I just want to walk up on stage and already, you know, look like something. And same goes for the studio. I want to walk into the room and immediately change some molecules around, you know, just by how it looks. And so then, you know, when you do open your mouth to start singing, it's like, okay, this is, you know, now this is happening on two levels, sort of, you know, it's a multidimensional, sort of approach.
I like to go into the dollar stores and look at the knockoff toys. That's my,
yes.
You know, it'll say Superman with two O's or something like that. And then it'll be like a action figure of Spider-Man. And you're just like, this is wonderful. This is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's so up my alley.
We totally need to hang out and go dollar store hunting. So now one of the things, you know, on your social media, you kind of call yourself the diet sprite of social media. And I know that you talked earlier about the positivity. And so, you know, what's the benefits versus the, you know, the pros versus the cons of social media for you?
I think Bob Gruen said something really amazing one time. There were a couple of us being interviewed for something, and you know, I think what he said was, you know, the internet is really powerful, you know, it gives everybody a microphone. The only thing is, you know, maybe not everybody's ready to have their mic turned on yet. And that's been my experience. You know, I think largely, I've used it as a way to try and spread some love and positivity if I can. But you know, my feed is full of, negativity. It's full of, you know, loud opinions that don't seem to require much critical thinking to arrive at. You know, I look at the atmosphere there and I wonder, you know, what are all these people getting out of this? You know, are these people who are, you know, making these crazy unfounded arguments about things, finding validation with, you know, being able to put ideas out there that maybe other people that they know or friends or family or whoever have maybe let them know that they didn't support. And so they're able to go on to Twitter or something and have people, you know, click a heart button a couple of times just because, you know, they agree with Marjorie Taylor Greene or whatever, you know, and maybe that makes them feel better about themselves, you know, in some way or whatever. But I just know from experience, like, there are so many ways to validate yourself that don't involve other people. And so to me, like, that's one of the pitfalls of it is like, it almost teaches you that there's a place you can go, you know, to be validated if you need to, rather than teaching you that, you know, you have the power to do that for yourself. So I think it's a powerful tool. I don't know how good or bad it is, but I, you know, it's the same thing as like TV advertisements that I used to see all the time, you know, as a kid, you know, watching television, you know, growing up in the 80s and 90s, you know, these people telling you, you know, everything that's wrong with you. You know, and social media has given people the power, like, they don't even need to work in an advertising firm to do that now. Like, they can just do that on their own platform to whoever they want, whenever they want to, you know? So I think it encourages some negative behavior, but I do see the potential for it to connect people and, in ways that, we haven't been connected before. So, you know, I'm hopeful that moving forward that, you know, we're able to, you know, do our due diligence to, you know, think critically about these issues and make sure that, you know, we're using these platforms to the full potential of their goodness.
I look at it a little differently. I look at it like, you know, some people are just dicks.
You be, man. I'm no expert, that's for sure.
I'm just kidding.
Well, I was thinking that later on I'm going to validate myself by listening to songs about pants, you know?
Yeah, man. There's a lot of good ones out there. I think you'll be happy with that choice.
Now, I know we've been talking for a while, and I don't know how much longer you've got, but I can't let you go without talking about your time with the New York Dolls and certainly thoughts on Sylvain recently after his passing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a magical time. It came along at a time where I was having a hard time. I had started a band called Semi Precious Weapons, and we in New York City in 2005 with Justin Tranter and Cole Whittle and Dan Crean, and we had gotten a record deal. Even Razor and Tie Records had signed us, and things were going okay. I had sort of been in this kind of tumultuous romantic relationship with one of the band members, and it's basically got to a place where it sort of made my position in the band kind of untenable. And so I stepped away, and they got asked to be the opening act on the Lady Gaga Monster Ball tour. And then they got signed to Interscope. And then they got a huge publishing deal from Warner Chappell, and their videos were all over MTV, and there were giant billboards of them up everywhere. And people were calling me to ask if I was okay, you know. And I was playing covers in the Red Lion, you know, on Bleecker Street, you know, literally playing, you know, Wild Night by Van Morrison. You know what I mean? Like, for a living, basically. I would occasionally get a little road work here or there. One time I took a tour, and I did the tour and I finished it, and the tour was so over budget that they couldn't afford to pay us when we got back. And in New York, man, you're living day to day, you're living dollar to dollar. And I had to give up my apartment, and I slept on the floor of my rehearsal space or in my van, you know. Or sometimes, you know, I was kind of too prideful to let people know that I didn't have anywhere to live. But I could occasionally, you know, just get drunk enough that my friend would be like, yeah, just sleep on my couch, you know, or whatever. That's kind of what my life was like. And one day the phone rang, and you know, Semi Precious Weapons' first album had been produced by Tony Visconti, and Tony had brought some of the New York Dolls to see Semi Precious Weapons play, and so that was where I initially met them. That was back in 2006, I think, they came to see us. And so this was 2008 now, and my phone rings, and it's this guy Steve Conti, who was playing the Johnny Thunders parts in the Dolls at the time. And he and his wife were having their first baby together, and so he needed some time to come off the road to be a new dad for a little while, and said, man, what would you think about playing some gigs with the Dolls? You know, do you still have, you know, are you still wearing those wild clothes? Do you have some interesting hair going on still, you know? And I jumped at the chance, obviously. I mean, one of the most influential rock and roll bands of all time, definitely a big influence on me. And I couldn't believe, you know, my good fortune that he would think of me to do this. So I learned 35 New York Doll songs from memory, and showed up at a rehearsal for we went to rehearse at SIR, and we played about 2 minutes of each song, and then David would stop the band and just move on, because I guess he felt like it was clear that I knew the songs. Although he didn't say anything about whether or not what I was doing was any good. But that's kind of to be expected in those situations. And then we got on a plane the next day and flew to South America and played the national soccer stadium in Lima, Peru, to 35,000 people.
Wow.
You know what I mean? It was a dream come true, man, in so many ways. And it just happened for me at this time in my life where I really was feeling down and just needed something, you know, to keep going. And so there came the New York Dolls, you know, there with that. And within the context of that band, you know, you have the two original members. You have David Johansen and you have Sylvain Sylvain. You know, Lenny Kaye wrote a beautiful letter when Syl passed away. And one of the things that he said that was so true, I think, is that Syl was really the linchpin of that band. He kept things in orbit. You know, he wanted that band to succeed so badly. And he wanted everybody in the band to be a rock star. That was Sylvain Sylvain. Wow. He was a rock star who wanted you to be a rock star too. You know, and that, man, that's just like a really rare, I'm getting a little emotional just thinking about like how powerful Sylvain's generosity was, you know, but that really was how he felt. You know, he would point to you when it was your turn to solo, God bless him. He would point to you and then he would point up at the sky, like take it as far as you can, man, go as crazy as you can with it. You know, this is your time now, you know, And so working with him, you know, in the Dolls was amazing. But then we continued our friendship and professional relationship after that. He invited me to partake as the guitar player in several of his solo projects that he was doing, one of which was a new band that never got named. I played guitar. Still with the front man, obviously. And then we had Tommy Price from Joan Jett and the Blackhearts on drums and Kenny Aronson from the Yardbirds on bass. And we even recorded some songs in Brooklyn that unfortunately never were able to get finished before Syl got sick. But, you know, the memory of just being, you know, of feeling like a guy like that wanted to include you will never leave me.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. I mean, they're such an amazing band, like the songs that they managed to do and just, you know, just so much of them and how much they really influenced music as a whole is incredible.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's interesting about the Dolls. You know, I a lot of people want to say that they invented punk rock music or were the, you know, well, and I think the reason that people want to say that is because there are these stories that we have from, you know, Johnny Ramone or whatever of going to see the Dolls before there was a Ramones. He, you know, went down to check it out, you know, at the Mercer Arts Center, just like everybody else was doing at the time. You know, you got to see the Dolls, man, you know, and Johnny's take on it was like, well, I could do that. You know, and so here come the Ramones, man. You know what I mean? That's sort of the power of the New York Dolls in a lot of ways. Like they, you know, they aren't just this band that, you know, sort of, you know, was doing a punk aesthetic before punk. I mean, I don't even really see them that way. When I talk to David about music, you know, he has a very deep respect and love of the blues and of classical music and of all sorts of different things that I don't think people would even really expect. I mean, you could have an incredible conversation about Gustav Mahler with that guy, you know. And I remember being in Rosario, Argentina at the Willie Dixon Blues Club, and the dressing room was covered in black and white photographs of blues singers with no nameplates on them. And David knew who every single one of them was. And he knew when their records came out, you know, and what label it was on. I mean, it was amazing. So, you know, in a lot of ways, like the New York Dolls really are one of those bands that touch a lot of different, you know, kind of aesthetics. And they were just, you know, really unique. And I think that's what, you know, what really turned people on about them and flipped people out about them is just like, I've never seen anything like this before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
How many bands can you actually say that about? I mean, really, you know.
Well, and in some cases it was their look, in some cases it was the song, in some cases it was the lyrics. Like everybody can grab a little something from each, whichever they want.
Totally.
And it brings up the interesting question of: is you can't put your arms around a memory the greatest song ever, or is the greatest song ever you can't put your arms around a memory?
I love that song so much.
It is a great song.
Jackie Gleason inspired that. He was watching.
Really? I did not know that.
He was watching Honeymooners, and Jackie Gleason said that on Honeymooners. Alice, you can't put your arms around a memory. And Thunders went, oh, there you go.
Well, you learn something new every day.
No doubt. That's awesome. Wow. So then, you know, we'll let you go soon. I don't know how much more time you have.
I got about 5 more minutes.
Okay. I'm interested, like, you know, with all this journey and now into Nashville, like, how important is this journey to you musically?
Oh, it's saved my life. I don't think I'd be alive, honestly. You know, and I just say that as a guy who was incredibly cruel to himself for a really long time, you know, and I found a place of joy and a place to belong and a place where I felt like I could, you know, all of my quirks and things that seemed to turn people off, you know, in life. Were suddenly things that could be celebrated. And, you know, so I really found a way to love who I am through music. And so that's, you know, for me, it's, I love the Jeff Buckley thing of I just want to give back to music what music's given me. Like, that's absolutely how I feel about it.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, and you can tell. Like, just listening to you, you can tell, you know, about your passion, and just, you know, it comes through. And so I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate that you've come on the show, and just, and I appreciate your music. So I look forward to hearing more of it. That's for sure.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you guys so much for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you both. And I hope we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, for sure. Well,
we want you to promote yourself here at the end, though. Don't leave without giving yourself a plug and telling everybody where they keep up with you.
Absolutely. You can find me all over the internet. AaronLeeTastian.com is the main jam, though. AaronLeeTastian.com, and you can find all sorts of glorious, you know, things to buy and things to look at and things to listen to and all sorts of stuff on there. And it also has links to all my various social media places if anyone wants to see me make wide swinging attempts to be overwhelmingly positive in an atmosphere where no one is interested in that. Come find me out there.
Oh, yes. Well, most certainly will. But yeah, I mean, like I say, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I wish you nothing but the best in the future. And yes, absolutely. Look forward to talking to you again.
Likewise. Same to y'all. Please stay safe and stay healthy.
And same to you. And now I'm going to go listen to Tazjin, Tazjin, Tazjin another like dozen times or so.
Means the world. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks a lot. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Up all my money and blew all of my money, 'cause I really don't care. I really don't care. Staying up all night, it could be good or it could be bad for you. It's gonna be all with my boyfriend, to go out with my girlfriend, 'cause love is like that, 'cause love is like that. Staying up all night, it could be good or it could be bad for you. It's gonna be all or it won't be. But I remember.